With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Okay.
Welcome to Going Off Track.
Welcome, Jonah. Welcome to my house.
We're here at Brad's house. It is so peaceful here, Brad.
Thank you. Not always. It's because school has started that it's so peaceful.
You know, you'd think, right in Manhattan, it would be loud and crazy, but it's pretty mellowed here.
We're over here at the edge of the world.
It's very nice.
Although we're supposedly going to get a little ferry stop over here.
Really?
Yeah, the Grand Street Ferry.
Nice.
So I'll be able to go over to Brooklyn and go to the smorgasburg or whatever.
You don't need it. You got CoSars over here. I got some whitefish. You got the pickle guys. I got some spicy pickles.
Donut
you got
the guys.
Donut. Yeah, donut plant.
I know. We're pretty good.
Well, what else do you need?
You got it pretty good.
Yes. Speaking of having it all.
We want to have it all.
Yes. Up top today, we wanted to thank some of the people who have been consistently supporting us on Venmo. We're toying with new ideas to try to give more incentives to you guys. We appreciate the donations in the meantime. Brad.
I think Ren Volpe at this point is going to have to be our new executive producer.
Ren Volpe.
And I want to thank Robert Gonio, who also gave a nice little something, and this guy Brandon Weinberg. So those people, I won't say what they left us, but it was more than the average.
It was bear. Not a, an Ed McNulty 69 cent, $4.20. We love you. We love you, Ed.
You can,
we
do love you, Ed. You can give us whatever you want, baby.
Ed is just such a handsome guy. He can get away with it.
But
with,
if you want to contribute, just at via Venmo, it's off track, and you'll see my name, Brad Worrell, will pop up just to kind of confirm that you're in the right place. And any amount is great. We could, we're just trying to stay out of the advertising modem.
Yes. So, and like I said, we're toying with some new ideas to give you guys some exclusive content and that kind of stuff. So if you're interested in that, let us know.
Yeah, so some big spenders, we might throw some bonus stuff your way.
Yeah.
And that would, be retroactive to anybody that hit us up earlier.
Yes. Venmo. So, Venmo/off track. Thank you for the donations. We really appreciate it. Today on the podcast.
Yeah, big one.
This is a very exciting podcast. I feel like for everyone, I felt like this was one I booked and then everyone was like, no way. We did a podcast with Living Color with Vernon Reed and Corey Glover.
It's amazing.
I can't believe it happened.
It's a great guest. Good job, Jonah.
Thank you. And shout out to their manager, Kevin. He really, really made this happen.
He solidified it.
Yes.
Dude, I mean, the crazy thing is this conversation that you're going to hear, which is great, only got better after we stopped. We had it. We went off track on off track. Like after we stopped rolling, these guys hung out in the lounge for like a half hour, right?
Dude, I think longer. I think like an hour.
And we just talked about like everything from like politics to child rearing to like music. We literally could have had another podcast from what we were just hanging out in the lounge.
Yeah, such, I mean,
smart. It was to the point where I was like, are they going to leave?
Yeah, such smart, interesting guys. That's what I was like, I hope they just stay forever.
Yeah, they like, really are both, they're great podcast guests.
Yes.
Because they both bring something different to the table and you'll hear it's amazing.
Yeah, podcast. So they have a new record called Shade. It just came out. It's awesome. It's great. And they just played Late Night with Seth Meyers. So you can check that out. They did that Monday. So you can, I'm sure you can find that online if you're savvy enough to listen to podcasts. And yeah, they just played a show with Professor Rage here. So it seems like they're just killing it. And it's so wild because when I was writing the summary for the podcast, I wrote something about Cult of Personality. I was like, when did this song came out? This song came out in 88. They formed in 84. And they kind of like look the same. And like they still just shred. Like it's pretty impressive for guys who have been doing it for like over 30 years. Right.
That's especially pretty, with this kind of music.
Yeah. So, yeah, I feel like they're at the top of their game. Shade is out now, and this is a pretty heavy podcast, I would say. Pretty current with what's happening in the world. Like I said, they're super intelligent guys and very well-informed. So, yeah, let's get into it with Vernon Reid and Corey Glover from Living Color.
It's going on
My parents were first-generation immigrants who grew up in Queens. My mom, too. It's like the same exact story as him. I'm like, how is it possible with such opposing, like, views?
Well, you know? that's like my latest kind of rant on Twitter has been about that. It's been about this whole idea of white supremacy is a dodge. You know what I mean? It's a denial of ethnicity. You know, like forging some kind of grand whiteness. It falls apart. If you just look at European history on any level, if you look at the conflicts between the French and, you know, the French and the English, I mean, and the other thing is, what makes anybody think that racial homogeneity is going to lead to some kind of great utopian thing? It doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
Look at the Korean Peninsula. It's a fabrication, but it's a fabrication that so many of us have bought into, and we're fighting over something that is completely fake. When you talk about fake news, this whole thing of whiteness is always, and Baldwin talked about this all the time, whiteness is always in relationship to the other. Mm-hmm. Because if the other's not there, right?
Yeah.
There's still going to be conflict. There's still going to be crime. There's still going to be crazy stuff going on. But the other is like, okay, we can ignore all of that, and they're the problem. And it's just, if you peel it away, just the layer of that onion, it's completely ridiculous.
So, who do you think fabricated that narrative, and for what advantage?
Well, the idea to dominate, to have some kind of faux scientific, because a lot of this is born out of the eugenics movement.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
A lot of it comes out of that. And the mm-hmm. whole idea of inferior people breeding, you know, people of low intelligence,
right.
If you will, you know. And it's like, if you think about it, like the Roma were caught up in it. The Jews in Europe were caught mm-hmm. up in it. You know, I mean, even before you get into the Asiatics people and the people of African descent, and of course, because African people are obvious because skins are darker, you can identify the other, boom, you can identify the Asian other. But these things are fallacious ideas because there was a lot of junk science. There was a lot of junk medicine. Like, there was a lot of trial and error,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of idiotic things got tossed out there as the real thing. And a lot of those things, you know, weren't actually applied. The empirical scientific method wasn't applied to them. They were notional things. You know, like women can't do science because their little brains can't absorb it. It's like right. It's fallacious stuff that's gone on. And the thing about it, like Grandpa has these crazy ideas. So the thing for people to leave those things, they have to literally. You have to deny what your parents tell you. You right. actually have to, if your parents yeah. are saying dumb shit to you, you have to say, that's some dumb shit, I'm not going to believe that. Well, sometimes that works and sometimes that doesn't, because you get haunted by the, you know, the thing you've always been told all sure. your life. Like, say you have a bad experience with a black person. Your person's an asshole to you. But you've been told that black people just blanket or they're thieving, they're lazy, they're lying, they're blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then you meet a guy who's actually a conniving, thieving dude.
Right.
What are you going to do? Is your impulse going to be, this guy is a fuckwit? Or is it going to be, see, I knew it?
It lends itself
and the,
to that
and the impulse, because to that thing, if you have a backdrop, you know what I mean, of that, and that goes both ways, right? If there's backdrop, oh man, white folks are just gonna be fucked up. It's gonna be fucked up. If that's the backdrop, or you've been told that your whole life, you can approach every situation and have the security of the knowledge that that's the truth when it's just a story you've been told.
And that being said, like what I find interesting about that and the movements that are going is that it feels like any subgroup can be emboldened now because of the not only the access to information, but the access to other people who believe that way. And that used to not be the case. You know, I even, out of sheer morbid curiosity, Googled Holocaust denial and looked into it for a brief time on the internet. And the scary thing I found about it was the well-researched, you know, these really well-thought-out, well-stated arguments for
erudition.
The Holocaust not existing, where if someone had gone into that Google search with the preconceived notion that it may not have existed, they just found themselves with a whole lot of information and a whole lot of friends who are kind of juicing them up on that. Do you think, like, social media and access to that positive and negative information, like, lends
we
into that
more? We hate
to be
wrong. We hate to be proven wrong. Just as human beings, we hate for our premises to be challenged. In a way, the scientific method is actually fights against that. And people who they've a lot invested. I'm an educated person, blah, 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 blah. I did da, 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 da. But your research could be wrong. And somebody across the world can take your thing and do the experiment and tell you, sorry, dude, with your PhD, you're wrong. And does the PhD guy go, oh, I guess I'm wrong? If he's invested more in the scientific method than he is in his own ego, he'll take his lumps. If he's not as invested in the rigorous scientific method, but he's invested in, I'm an educated guy, I went to Harvard, I'm a smart guy. If he's invested in that, then he's going to find a way to reject it.
Mm-hmm. That's based on ego.
But there's a partly an evolutionary basis even for that. You know what I mean? So like these sorts of things, of course somebody is going to be erudite. You know, like it's been said the devil can cite scripture for its purpose.
Sure.
Like the devil knows the Bible. In fact, who has more in common, an atheist and a Catholic, or an atheist and, or a Catholic and a Satanist?
Right.
The Satanist believe.
The
Satanist believes the narrative.
Sure.
The Satanist is the adversary. Mm-hmm. So they have much more in common, and they're both more invested in the narrative.
Right. Sure.
Yeah, but only one was referenced in an Eagles song, so it goes that bad way.
You know, you can find a lot of shit in those Eagles songs. Hotel California, Jim.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the record, but I also, just because of what's happening in the world right now, I had a question with everything that's happening. Please. Is it, because I thought
what's happening, Jenna?
With the white supremacists and that stuff. I mean, what you were saying about Grandpa, I mean, I was so surprised that there were so many young people on that side. Yeah. I thought that generation dies out, our generation
no,
comes
No, because their parents are baby boomers. And a lot of the parents of these kids are baby boomers. And rebellion is a factor always in separating oneself from one's parents. So they've been told a bunch of things. And if those things are just kind of window dressing, right? There's a certain kind of liberalism that also hides white supremacy and hides racism as well.
Exactly. Sure does.
You know
sure
what
does.
I mean? Part of the thing that like, we have a dialogue that conservatives are inherently racist and liberals are inherently, you know, are not racist. But those notions can be broken down. You know, on closer examination, of course, there are liberal people that are not, but they're, you know, but they're folks that are like, I've seen it, you know, where there's a kind of you people thing that's like, well, you don't know, you'd like, I'm a category.
Sure.
You know, or people like the blacks are a category. You know, the Native Americans are a category. And of course, we support their whatever it is. But if you look closer, and kids see that falseness, and they go, man, chuck all of that, man. It's like, you know, and also, it's this is the thing, you must not believe this. We don't, and some kids also, are going to go for it.
There's also some confirmation bias involved in that as well.
100.
You know, like you were saying earlier, if like if one person does the one thing that grandpa said that they do, he was right.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
He was absolutely right. And the falsity of it all is that there's a parity to it. There is no parity to it. One denotes power and the other one denotes fighting against power.
Right.
So white supremacy says, I want to maintain power. Anti-white supremacy says, I want to tear that shit down.
Right.
You deal with that, and it's a constant battle. There is no parity to it. There is no, it's a false thing that you're constantly fighting against, and you're constantly seeing it as an observer, but you can't observe. You're in the middle of it. Mm. But you can't see from that.
But there's like this fear. Like one of the things that we hear politicians say all the time is, you know, let's level the playing field. And the person that says level the playing field has always got the field tilted in their direction.
Exactly.
Right. Of course. Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the terrific bromides that gets thrown out there. You know, because we see it statistically, we see it in sentencing disparities. Mm-hmm. We see it in sentencing disparities. Same crime. Criminal did the same thing, breaking into a house. The white criminal gets one thing and the black criminal gets something else. They're both criminals. They both did it.
Mm-hmm.
But routinely, the sentence will be different. And in school discipline, mm-hmm. one kid gets a timeout, one kid gets sent to detention.
Right.
Routinely. And the teachers that are doing it, if you talk to them about it, the individual teachers, oh my God, they would be horrified.
They don't think they are.
Of course they're not. Mm-hmm. But the darker kid, when he jumps up and he's being boisterous, seems more threatening.
Right.
Because he's the unknown, unknowable, unknown other. Mm-hmm. Whereas the blonde kid that jumps up, you're like, oh, he's just like my nephew. You're an idiot. Sit down. Omar jumps up and does the same thing, say, you know, to the principal's office. He's doing the same thing.
Right.
But because the darker classmate is unknown and unknowable and is frightening, because that's what that is. Those kind of things go. And if you take those individual things and you bundle, it's like bundling mortgages. Like, you suddenly have a thing that a frightening statistic, or you suddenly have, you know, the mortgage crisis.
So is that person with that in like that implicit bias, the person who really doesn't even think they're racist and actually is, like, are those people at a certain age like a lost cause? Where like
I don't believe anyone's
like
lost.
How do you peel that back? Like, how do you get?
Well,
to
we
that,
have to get to
know?
A place where people actually get to, you know, like, we have to have more freedom around each other. All of us are very are handcuffed around each other. Like,
yeah.
If I cut you off and I'm being an idiot, I'm being an idiot.
Sure.
Right? So one thing is, if I'm being an idiot, it's not about my blackness. It's about me being an idiot.
Right.
Right? So we have to have a kind of freedom where, you know, you can look at a person and actually see them. The worst thing, the terrible thing about racism is that we don't see each other clearly. We can't see each other clearly. We can't see the good. We can't see the bad because it's shrouded in anecdotal falsities. And this happened to my cousin. It's all an urban myth. This is what, you know, that happened. And there was, and they gang raped this person. That happened. Blah, 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 and all of those kinds of things. And then we act out of anecdotal
fear.
These anecdotal things. You know, mm-hmm. Willie Horton.
Sure.
Like, Willie Horton was a textbook example of the salient exemplar. And that's the one story, the anecdote, that proves the general rule.
Right.
And you can sweep all the other stuff away. And you know what? They looked for that case and they found it. They didn't talk about all the times that the parole worked. They're not going to talk about all the times. You know what? That guy, he actually became a upstanding member of his community. That's not what they don't want that story.
Right.
Because
right.
that story is not the story that's going to change the outcome of the race.
Mm-hmm.
They need, this guy got parole and he murdered some people. And that's the story, that's the brush that paints everybody else mm-hmm. that's in prison. That, you know, everyone else that did time, you know, it's kind of this thing. We're a very punitive society. It was funny that we, as a country that claims broadly to be a Christian country, how unforgiving and how unmerciful we are with sentencings and things like that.
People forget the Samaritan wasn't a Christian.
No. Well, you know, he's the good Samaritan, which makes you wonder what happened to all the other Samaritans. Mm-hmm.
I think about this. Right.
What made him good?
Yeah.
What was the one thing?
He's,
that made
he's like the last
priest.
Last
the priest
Samaritan.
Didn't do shit. Yeah. What happened to Samaritan? Obviously, too good. I find the whole tragic irony of all this is that I'm like in high school and I first hear Living Color and I'm listening to Letter to a Landlord and here I am, 45, and we're having the same damn conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's like I'm, you know, literally eyes opened up and I grew up outside of D.C. You know, right. It's Bad mm-hmm. Brain City,
yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that. Naive child, teenager, that happens.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And now, 45 years, or I'm 45, but like years later, I'm like, God damn it. We're still here. Am yeah. I still not? Was I still naive? What naivete did I have to fight through to?
Well, you tend to think that, like Vernon was saying, that these one incidents change everything. These one incidents don't change the narrative. They just, they either reinforce or they buck against it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you hear a group of people saying, this is not right, this is not right, and you hear it enough, you go, whatever, I'm tired of hearing you say it's not right. But it doesn't make it not right. You know, you get fatigued from hearing about what the problem is, and rather than fixing the problem, we're trying to figure out where the nugget of truth is in that scenario, you just decide to ignore it and go on with the rest of your life. Well, and then when faced with it, you have to deal with it.
Well, it's like the reaction to Black Lives Matter, which was so fascinating. Because Black Lives Matter is a cry. When Black Lives Matter came out, it was also a cry for help. It was like, we're being murdered with no recompense. We're like, and one of the responses when these things happen is that somebody will say, just comply with the officer's instructions. And it's like, you've never, and this is because the fundamental relationship with the police, the person saying that, they've never been pulled over by the cops. They've never been in that position. So Officer Joe is always right.
Mm-hmm.
And to say anything other than that, you're anti-police. But certainly, you know, we have close police officers. I have two cousins. We have a friend of the band who's practically family.
Right.
Who's a detective. He, you know, he retired. My cousins retired. One was a transit cop. One was a beat cop. Never fired their weapons.
Yeah.
You know, they served with honor and distinction. I'm proud of them. But so when I talk about my abhorrence of excessive force, it comes from a place of, you know, I know that good policing exists. Most cops are not popping off their guns, but they're people that should never be cops in the first place. They should never be cops in the first place. In any, think about, let's leave racial thing, sexual assault. Like cops sexually assaulting women, it's an epidemic thing. It's crazy town. And most women who are, you know, get their ass grabbed by a cop, they don't report it.
Mm.
Because who's going to believe?
Who are they going to report it to?
Who's going to report it to? Yes. Report yeah. to the cops, right?
Sure.
Every movie you see, how are IA, internal affairs, how are they portrayed? They're rats. They're disgusting.
Rat squad.
They're the worst. They're the shill for the brass. I mean, that's the thing that's funny. Like, this Blue Lives Matter thing came up. And I just like, you know, I just thought to myself, every other movie I've ever seen in my life, we could list movies that are based on the lives of cops and TV shows. We would talk from now on. What are you talking about, Blue Lives Matter? Adam 12, Ironside. Oh, my God. Madigan. We could go on and on and on and on and on.
SWAT.
And on. Bullet. The Seven Ups.
Bloods.
Right. You know.
You can't throw in the wire. We can throw that in, right?
That's, of course. Okay. But you know, I mean, the lives
there's,
of...
There's still some piece of shit cops in the wire.
That's quite I mean, few, yeah.
They're
yeah.
pretty bad.
Yeah.
But it, I don't... It, it's a very funny thing. Like, well, why can't we talk honestly about when cops are, you know, are doing the wrong thing?
And that's where, you know, I'm getting to the point with a lot of this stuff where I'm like, all right... It's pretty well-worn territory how we got to some of these points and the point we're at, yeah. right? The thing I'm wondering now is, like, as someone from my side, when I watched the Eric Garner video, I was like, all right, how the fuck you dispute this? You know what I mean?
And
this is too obvious. This is so over the top. This is finally going to be the one
yeah.
that just goes this way. And then, like you said, a movement starts that's literally like, fuck, stop killing us, please. You know what right. I mean? Not even like a response that seems far-fetched in the least. And from someone like my side, I'm seeing Eric Garner, I'm seeing his movement come out, and then I see the Blue Lives Matter reaction. I'm like, what does it actually take? Like, how can this narrative be portrayed in a way that people finally... are compassionate, understand, and can actually finally put themselves in the shoes of another person, listen to their stories, and actually move on from there and actually take steps from there. Like what the fuck is it going to take if that didn't do it?
Well, we have to, there have to be other narratives.
Am I cursing too much,
I don't know. No. It's just weird. It's funny because if somebody is unmovable on a particular point and there's no way in, I don't know. Because on a certain level, we have to be able to move one another emotionally. We have to be able to take that on, to take on the pain of the other, take that on. And many people are unwilling to do it because it will dislodge a lifetime of a comfort, a mm-hmm. lifetime of a thing that's just letting stuff go, you know. That's why traumatic events, a lot of people have gone through traumatic events, a traumatic disease, a traumatic thing. One of the things that people say if they survive is that this is the best thing that ever happened to me because it shook me. I got shook. And if people come out the other side of it and say, I'm a different person because I understood the value of just the quotidian every day, the things that we take for granted every day. You know, it's a hard thing. You know, there was a video. It was one of those videos that was leaked, and it was very controversial. It was during the war in Iraq, and I think this was part of the thing that got my man. What's my man who's living in Russia now?
Snowden.
Right. He leaked this thing, and there was a. This helicopter shot up a bunch of people, and one of the pilots said, "Well, that's what you get." But if you look at the footage, there's a Marine who grabs a kid, and he picks up the kid, and he's running with this kid to get the kid to a medic. And when you see this Marine grab a kid and he's running with the child to give the child medical attention, it's like that's what it's about. Mm. Like that dude. That Marine, that nameless person that saw a kid that got shot and did his duty. That's what this is. You know, and he's not celebrated. Nobody's, you know, but that's the line. Like and people that actually do the right thing. This girl, Heather, that got hit, that got run down.
Yeah.
You know, that's what that is.
It's like the reverse of what you're talking about. You know, you hear about you're lumping one culture in with one bad person. The opposite never happens when one good person does one thing. I grew up on an army base and saw a 19-year-old MP beat a 12-year-old with a billy club when I was 12 at a very young age. And it affected me greatly in how I feel about the police. Sure. Greatly. Yeah. Met plenty of other police who were kind and whatever. But still, that hit me hard as, you know... random white kid. And so now, but, and so it's hard for me to spin it like you're saying with like the good on the other side. It's difficult.
Well, those things, I'll tell you, there was something I saw that wasn't like super dramatic and it affected me greatly. And it's not even deep. There were these kids, a bunch of kids. It was the Upper East Side. They were in a pizza.
And you grew up in the city, right?
Grew up in the city, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm in this pizza joint. There's a bunch of kids, and it's a mixed group of kids: a Latino kid, white kid, black kid, and they're just being kids. They're goofing off. The pizza guy doesn't mind. He's cool, and they're just being boys, you know, acting, throwing shit at each other, you know, being kids. And a cop walked in. And the cop walked into the pizza place, and the dudes all settled down. And I thought, that's not right. They're not doing anything wrong. They're being, why should your presence suck the joy out of the room? I had a big problem with that. He didn't shoot nobody. He ain't swing the club. He just changed the atmosphere. And it wasn't like, and the thing is, if the guy making the pizza was complaining about their actions, but it wasn't like that. They were, you know, they were like, I guess, regulars, and he was cool. He was making his pie, and there was blah, blah, blah. And the cop walked in, and everybody just, and the whole thing was like the temperature went down like 15 degrees. And he didn't interact with me. He didn't give me a vibe, but I just watched it. And I said, that's not cool. That's not cool. That's not cool to be that person.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like, if the cop said, yeah, don't worry. If the cop would turn around, say, hey, dudes, don't worry about it. Yeah, come on. But he kind of got off on it.
Right. Yeah. I guarantee you, he did not know those kids. Those kids did not know him.
Right.
The whole idea of community policing is that you know the neighborhoods you're living in. 100. And that you live in those neighborhoods, that you know exactly where you are and what you're doing and what goes on in that neighborhood because you actually live here. Part of, you know, the changes in policing was that they didn't want you to be a part of the community. They wanted you to be above the community.
Mm.
And that idea created a schism and creates a hierarchy that doesn't make things better. It makes things worse.
Right. You know how they
adversarial.
You know how they quelled Tiananmen Square. So the protesting Tiananmen Square were going on, and it got to the point where it was going out of control, and they couldn't get the local cops. The local army would not intervene because they knew all of the people.
Mm-hmm.
So they were called. So the people, the protesters, knew that they went to school with these guys, right? So they would call them out, and at a certain point, it was growing. So what the authorities did, they got a set of officers from the extreme north of China. They got officers that they knew had no familial connection to the people in Tiananmen Square, and they're the ones that cracked down because they didn't know them at all.
That's why I think I got smarter just sharing a couch with you guys.
Thank
you. I had a question sort of about the new
music. How about music?
Oh, fine. That old trope.
Yeah. So you guys have first record in 8 years.
Yikes!
Where the speak going? About history.
I mean, how did this come together? I mean, was this something that you guys had been wanting to do for a while, or when did it feel sort of right to kind of get back into it?
Well, we it was funny. We started with the title, and we had the title Shade, and then we did this thing at the Apollo where we were part of the celebration of the centenary of Robert Johnson, and we did the Preaching Blues, and the way we did it, it was crazy because we couldn't rehearse it. It was really fly by the seat of our pants, and we went on and we did it and it worked, and because it worked, I thought this record Shade that we named, because Corey and I kind of came with the name.
I wanted to call it Synesthesia, but nobody else wanted to. But anyway.
Do you have it?
I just wanted to call the last record Synesthesia.
I did. I want to use this word Synesthesia at some point in my life.
That's so good.
Corey Glover. I want to be able to put it in a sentence.
Corey Glover.
Corey Glover, synesthesia.
I'm a synesthesia.
So then I thought, well, this blues has got to be some kind of thread. There's something about doing this and us connecting to this song in this moment. So then that was the thing. I said, you know, this is somehow connecting metal and hard rock to blues, or you know, because there's a connection to it from even some of the early heavy bands like Sabbath. You know, had a heavy kind of blues basis. You know, Motorhead had a heavy blues basis for the
Deep Purple.
Deep Purple, yeah. Big time. Had a heavy blues basis, and we wanted to. So, but we also didn't want to do a boogie record we didn't want to do a blues record. So it was like threading this needle where blues is a thread that goes through all of the narratives and all the things, without it being overtly a blues record. But so, and that was a kind of a guiding principle. And then we went into it and we started kind of amassing songs. And then at the end, and there was fits and starts and, you know, and things happened. And then next thing you know, we had a bunch of pieces of music, and then we had to figure out what the narrative was. And we really pulled together all the songs that seemed to tell a story. And that was pretty much it.
Do you guys do stuff like send files back and forth, or do you like just getting in the space together?
We did everything.
All of it.
All of it. We did files. We did this record in 4 different studios over time. And we had a point where we had enough songs for it to be a record, and we really had a breakdown, and then the writing wasn't done. We didn't have everything. There were certain sounds and things that we did not have. And that caused a kind of a schism, you know. We had some, you know, some difficult times between us and our producer.
Were you taking the same producer to all 4 studios, or were you working with different people?
No, we worked with the one producer in the one studio, and then we actually went away, and just the 4 of us did some tracks.
Where'd you guys go? We recorded Preaching Blues 7 times.
7 times? I thought it was
7.
Lucky I think 7. You get that seventh son of a seventh son mythology in your memory, man.
No, we recorded Preaching Blues right after we did the Apollo thing twice. Then we did it at Dre's. Then we did it again. And then we did it again. We did it every studio that we went into. The song that we did
like 4 or 5 times.
Nope.
Not
trying to tell you.
We might have takes that we didn't use. No. Anyway,
was that the schism?
One of many. Schizai.
You guys need some synesthesia here. I don't even know. What is
that? What color did the schism sound like?
It's like smelling colors.
Yeah.
John Mayer says he has it.
Oh my God, a record makes so much more sense now. Jonah, you may be the only one in this room who remembers this, but the Guilt record, Synesthesia.
Yes.
There's an old hardcore band called Guilt.
Yeah.
And every song was a color.
Right.
And thank you. This record makes a lot more sense to me.
You just left. You did learn something. That's good.
It's not that you see colors, right? You hear, like, you hear.
Your senses do what the opposite
they,
is.
They opposite. Do the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for Guilt for being thematic all the way back in the mid-90s.
What's the dynamic like between you two, having kind of been friends and bandmates for, what, like 30 years or something? I mean, do you guys just know what the other person's going to say?
Just stand up, John. Just let it happen.
You're so lucky to be right
it's
here.
It's a rich broth. A smoldering cauldron of resentment and fear.
Fuck off, Vernon.
You know, we get on each other's nerves.
Yes.
And get on each other. We push each other's buttons.
Have you ever considered making a Metallica Some Kind of Monster type of documentary where you guys go into group counseling and really just
and then the therapist help us lyrics? That was my favorite part of the whole thing. Oh,
and then maybe Will will be willing to do the Saint Anger snare sound, which is up for it. I don't know. What? Yeah. It's great. No? No one?
I was curious, you know, one of the themes on the record seems to be mass media and those types of ideas, for-profit media. I mean, and that seems like something that's sort of been throughout your career. I mean, How did you guys kind of tackle that, maybe specifically on the new record, or what did you feel like you wanted to kind of make come across?
Well, you know, when you have all you have in front of you, all we have, my phone keeps buzzing because all I have is media in front of me. This, where we are right now, is for the purposes of making media, that all we deal with is media and not really the emotions and the emotional heft that comes from these places and from these things and out of these devices. And we oftentimes are caught up in those things. We get caught up in a tweet storm. We get caught up in, but we get caught up in on some threat, Reddit thread or whatever it is. But we don't talk about the emotional impact of A, where it came from, and B, where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
So it's weird because at one point there's kind of the big brother model, you know, the all seeing eye that's watching all of us. But now we've shifted to everybody watching everyone else.
Right.
And reporting on it.
You know, and reacting.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so we've created this kind of organic programming environment.
You created some kind of monster. Hey, it all comes back.
Bucket of fish.
We're here all week, folks.
The thing I liked about when listening to the record was that immediately you know who you're listening to. You know who's singing. You know the guitar. Like, immediately. And I think that says a lot to Living Color that
for sure.
you have a sound. And I remember the first time hearing them, like, the hell is this? And still listen to it. And when you, is that something that's inherent? Like do you have tones and style in your head? Are you, it's just kind of automatic when you're creating the song, or does that happen in the studio?
That's actually a really good question, because, you know, living with the various tunes, it's interesting that, like, there were things I did at the very top, because we would play and we did it first take, and then we go through iterations to put a song away, write a bunch of other songs, pull the song back out. Okay, I'm going to do a whole other series of overdubs, and then wind up using the original thing that I did the first time, because it actually was the thing that felt the best. Like a song, Freedom of Expression, like the original guitar solo, is the guitar solo is on it, is the guitar solo I recorded when we first did the track. Or, you know, Two Sides was kind of recorded live in the studio and then was shaped into this piece. And that's exactly what happened the very first time we did it. Other tunes, you know, it's different. But a lot of times that first contact, you know, because that's one of these weird things, because you can always do it better, but better isn't necessarily it. Like, right. Another lick that's fancy is not necessarily the thing that actually speaks in the moment of the song.
It's that old Picasso quote where he's like, art isn't finished, it's abandoned.
I love that.
I wish we could abandon it.
Well, the smart thing is to abandon things at the right time. Right.
Yeah, that's like, the key.
Sometimes you keep feeding it and feeding it, and it just turns into something you never wanted in the first place.
Well, kind of, because, you know, there's so much anxiety around producing work. You know, what are people going to say? What are you going to feel about it? You know, there's so much anxiety about, is it loud enough? Can we make it louder? Can we get that? Can we do that? This, that, the other thing. And at a certain point, the snare drum is a snare drum is a snare drum.
Yeah.
Like, you can bring in a snare drum from Morocco. You can bring a snare drum. An old, you know, a relic from the 20s.
Tell that to William Calhoun.
But at the end,
dare you.
But you know.
Yo, he earned it. I'm the drummer in the room. He earned it, Will. Will, if you're listening, you earned it, baby. You earned it. Get that snare right.
Did you see the Springsteen thing on HBO when they showed the recording of Darkness, and they tried to get a record? It was like Jimmy Iovine was the engineer, and they're trying to Max Weinberg would hit the snare drum, and they would go, stick, And they thought they could, they wanted to get the sound of the stick hitting the snare away. Huh. So they would go, no, we heard the stick again. Stick, heard the stick. And they talk, they interviewed them in like in hindsight, and Bruce Springsteen's like, I don't know what I was doing. Sorry. Really sorry.
You know what I mean? Music is funny because we Monday morning quarterback everything that happens in culture. Like if a movie comes out and does the thing, we go back. Of course it was genius because it was da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Mm-hmm. You know, if a movie's a flop, it's a flop, right? Everybody has high hopes. All those very skilled people, all those people with all of their experience go in to do a thing. And they do the thing, and then the thing is people don't, you know, whatever. It doesn't work for whatever reason. And that's, and whether it's popular or not, it's more like, well, is this thing an actual thing or is it not so much?
And that's timing too, though, isn't it? I mean, when you can make something 10 years before that flops, it just connects with somebody at the right time.
Absolutely.
Out of your control.
How is sort of the like promotion of this record must be so different, and yeah, you know, as opposed to like doing Headbangers Ball or going on MTV or doing that kind of stuff to doing podcasts. I mean, what's that sort of been like? Do you kind of miss?
Well, it's hyper niche. Well, you know what the thing about it is? It's like we're into the era of the hyper niche, the hyper. You know, like say like a podcast. Like I'm a big podcast head. Like Welcome to Night Vale.
Yeah.
Is its own thing. And most people don't know what Welcome to Night Vale is.
I started listening to that new one, the Wire, but, Louder the Wire is the one.
What?
There's another one, the Welcome to Night Vale. Now they have their own network, so they have a new show. They're just, it's like right. In season two. But yeah,
what, Alice Isn't Dead, or there's some kind
something
of crazy.
Like that, yeah.
So these things, weirdly enough, and then you all listen to a podcast and they say, oh yeah, we're going to have a live show at blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, word? It's like, and there literally is a crowd of people, you don't know who they are, have found this thing, and they believe in the thing, and they're going to be part of the thing. And I think part of what is happening now is that, you know, for bands and artists and comedians and what have you, people are having to do the kind of work that reaches out, and they have to find their niche. Or expand whatever it is, whatever fan base they have.
Did you read the book, The Long Tail? I think it's Chris
The Long Moore. Tail. I've had The Long Tail read at me.
Read at you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Screaming it at you? What happened?
No, I have the film director I work with. He was obsessed with the long tail thing.
It's a neat theory. It works out. I remember interviewing a band one time where they said the singer would suggest he would sing ideas for guitar solos to the guitar player. I want to know if that ever happened.
Well, Cult of Personality, the riff to Cult of Personality was Corey was singing something to me and I stumbled on the riff.
And
I played something, it was totally different than what he was singing to me.
Right.
But it was that thing. And from the moment, from the moment of that first riff, the song wrote itself. Huh. Literally, it started to, it took over the room. It made itself manifest.
It's awesome. How many takes did you take on that solo?
On that solo, it's the second time all the way through. Damn. There's actually an alternate, there's actually somewhere, because Ed Stasem, I did the first solo and Ed actually liked it. And it's very different. And I was sitting there and he said, we'll do some more tomorrow. And I was sitting in the booth, I got to do one more right now. I said, let me do one more right now. And that one is, that take is all of the, from the top to bottom is one take.
Wow. Cool.
The thing for me, my connection to it is, yeah, it's like the most well-known, it's most popular song the band did. But the fact that it unfolded and made itself, and we did not stop it.
Until it was done.
From making itself. Like, we didn't throw a monkey wrench. We didn't do anything that interrupted it making itself. And that's a magical thing to be a part of. And we played that song like the very next. We had a CBGB's gig like a few days, and we debuted that. We wrote the song, and then we played it at CBGB's on the very next show. And it was instantly people, oh, my God. What song is that? And it's just one of those one of those things that happens, you know, and it was it's very special.
It's very, I was going to ask about that. Anyway, I'm glad you brought it up because I know you guys formed in New York City in what was the exact year?
84.
And then
good God almighty.
And when you guys came together, were you a part of that? Like, New York City club scene?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was it's weird. It's like speaking of Manhattan as a kind of Jurassic Park.
Oh, it's like Nazareth.
It's weird. It's completely. I saw Blue Cheer. I saw Blue Cheer, which is weird. It was weird because it was like you wouldn't expect to see Blue Cheer play the Danceteria. Yeah.
Wow.
It was crazy. They were playing Summertime Blues at ear-splitting volume. It was like...
It's a really good version.
I saw Nick Cave's first show.
Wow. Where was that?
And that was also Danceteria, and Barry Adamson was playing bass with them at that time. So it was...
Not Birthday Party, Nick Cave?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, he was first. His first thing away from the birthday
Holy
place
shit.
Is Nick Cave, his first solo thing.
He wasn't even 6 feet tall yet.
So there's all of those kind of crazy, you know, just crazy experiences.
I remember hearing an interview with you guys, and I learned about bands from you. And I think it was an interview, I can't remember where because I watched it, about the Black Coalition musicians. And you had mentioned Bad Brains, who I knew, being from Northern Virginia. You legally have to.
Right. Yeah.
Which is important. And 24/7 Spies was another 24/7 one, I think, Spies. At the time. Right?
And we saw like one of the first times they played Reignition. It was crazy at the World. It was actually before they made Eye Against Eye.
Right.
We saw them play Reignition. Wow. It was like Reignition. Bad Brains played shows. Like, anyone that knows Bad Brains, like, their shows were godhead. Like, they played a show. Yeah. They moved the Ritz uptown to 54th Street. And the Ritz had a low-hanging balcony. And the balcony was really low over the crowd. And they played this show right around the time of The Youth Are Getting Restless. And people started leaping from the balcony into the pit. And so when the first dude did it, then people start pouring off the balcony into. I've never seen anything before since. Like the entire place became a swirling miasma of bodies leaping and people running around. The security guards were like, "They just
yeah, what do." Me and Vernon, we played this show with the Bad Brains. We opened for the Brains at this place called The World downtown. It's not there anymore. And Vernon and I are in the balcony talking, and they're doing Pay to Come now. What most people don't know about HR is that he's an Olympic diver. Yeah. He would have gone to the Olympics in Russia if the Afghani thing didn't happen in the 80s. He was going to the Olympics. They played Pay to Come, and there's this thing at the end. Was like, da, 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 da. HR jumped in the air. Did a somersault and landed on the one.
The standing somersault. He standing somersault.
Wait, landed on the one?
He landed on the one. Well, you know, we're sorry, because Nils Lofgren used to do, and it, you know, used to do his thing. He used to use a jump, because he was an acrobat. So he used to have a jumpling where he would run, and he would hit this jumpling and do a tumble. But HR did a standing somersault on the one. And I think Corey and I looked at each other and were like, what?
Why are we doing this?
Man, you know, I'm telling you, man, like, it was like the early shows with Fishbone. Fishbone, the original Fishbone, was when they were, you know, I'm talking about, they were 18 or 19 years old.
Oh, wow.
And it was out of control.
Hmm.
You had never seen anything, a stage performance, anything like it. I used to hate having to do shows with them because it was just ridiculous.
Just like it's around Truth and Soul era?
Yeah.
We did a show with them. Who was that show in Santa Monica? Santa Monica Civic Center. It was us, Stetsasonic, Fishbone
and Public Enemy.
And Public Enemy.
Wow. Oh, fuck.
Public Enemy. That was a crazy, crazy, crazy show.
I've never seen a mosh pit that big in my life. It was a sea of bodies just roiling over each other. There was a like this
circle that was going around that was the circumference of the Santa Monica Civic Center.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was great shit.
And then someone got stabbed.
It was great shit.
A lot of cool.
But all these bands that you're talking about, like you guys, Bad Brains, 27 Spies, like everybody could really play. And I feel like at the time, at least for me, Living Color was one of my introductions into bands. I was like, oh, these guys, they can play. Like learning about musicianship.
Right.
You know, and it seemed taken as seriously as the songwriting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, we were a band that was forged by, you know, on the one hand, well, Bad Brains, they were fusion guys.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know what I mean? And so a lot of hardcore owes a lot to the Mahavishnu Orchestra. Like a lot of prog rock and...
Oh, cut me.
Speaking of media.
You've that orchestra alert.
That's Living Color's guy Kevin fucked up my phone.
It's sitting in here talking to us. See, this is the reason I won't look at pornography on my computer anymore.
Did you think it's looking back at you?
It is.
Jerking off?
It definitely is. I got tape. I got tape over my cameras, man. I ain't into that.
We all have tape over our cameras, Benny.
Brandon, what were you saying about hardcore?
You know, hardcore like owes a lot to like some of the, you know, like hardcore in Prague owes a lot to some of the fusion bands like Mahavishnu Orchestra and things like that. I mean, early, like, when I saw Black Flag, I was like, wow, like, they're really intense.
Mm-hmm.
Saw them at the Old Ritz.
When you look back, I mean, like, you know, even Descendants, you know, all those guys can really play.
Oh, you know,
like, insane.
Helmet. Page is a beast.
Mm. He's
Page
a monster.
Is a real guitar player, though. Like, you know, like.
I saw Helmet open for Faith No More, and I remember, like, speaking of Faith No More, like vocalist at the time for me when I was in high school was Corey Glover and Mike Patton. Like,
right.
You guys were like of the same ilk. The things you could do with the pipes, it still mystifies me. Being able to, it sounded like you're tearing your voice up and then singing like an aria. Like, mm-hmm. is that something you're born with, or is that something you learn, or
it's who you live with. Causes all of that stuff. Just causes the joy and the pain, and you know, I live with him.
We don't live together.
Like when I found out like you were replacing Carl Anderson, I was like, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously.
That was a dream come true for me.
I can only imagine.
Yeah. Because my whole interpretation of what a rock singer sounded like was Carl Anderson from Jesus Christ Superstar.
Flat out.
Like, and if I could sound like that, I could be in a rock band. And I didn't think I sounded like that, but you know. I thought I sounded like something else. So, but I wanted to do that. And then, you know, somebody introduced me to hardcore music and I was like, oh, I want to do that too.
Yeah.
You know, and then I heard HR and I was like,
oh man,
fuck it. I can't do this shit.
There's footage of Brian Baker in one of the gazillion legally mandated documentaries about the DC scene talking about how the first Minor Threat show, they had to go on and Bad Brains was playing and they were like, oh, fuck. Like everyone has that reaction whenever Bad Brains is on the bill. Like,
right.
Gah.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's part of the thing. You got to show it.
But that's cool. Having that kind of competition, I think, makes people better and you want to have a good show. And you also are a fan of who you're playing with, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good, man. It was, I remember, man, so many of those CBGB shows. It was fun just listening to other bands, listening to the folks do their thing. It was great.
Was it scary at all? Because I read all these hardcore memoirs and they're like, I stabbed this guy here. This guy got a bottle cracked over his head, like all the Cro-Mags books and that stuff.
I mean, I don't know, man. I you know, I those were not the shows I saw.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. All of those, like the Circle Jerk shows, Cro-Mag shows that I saw were great. I mean, there was, you know,
they were, you know, when you go see those kind of bands in New York, no one's coming there to prove anything. It's like, I'm home, I'm gonna have a good time,
right.
And that's what the audience felt. That's how I felt. It's like, they're back, I'm gonna be there,
right?
And I always got the impression that there was that sense of competition carried over into something else outside of their circle of friends and that they had to deal with it then. They had to deal with some sort of like rougher competition at that point. Like, you guys think you're the hot shit, but you know.
I dealt with it more outside of New York.
Yeah.
I can see that.
I want to segue that into the decision to cover Who Shot You.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's a song that talking about different sides and outside of where you are.
Well, Who Shot You was funny because it really was born out of we were just talking about stuff to do. And I was like, we should record Who Shot You because Corey would always, during our sound checks, would always bust out the rhyme. And then we put it together. And then Andre and Corey decided that he would sing it as opposed to rapping it. And it worked out well. I mean, it's funny because it's not a blues tune. But how it really fits in Shade is that the narrative of Christopher Wallace is a blues story. When you consider what, you know, he did Who Shot You, it was really directed Tupac Shakur because Tupac Shakur was shot and wounded in New York City outside of Quad recording. And Who Shot You was really kind of, it really kind of set off a lot of the problems that the two of them had with each other. But then when you consider what actually happened to Biggie in the end, I mean, that, in a larger sense, made the song very compatible with the things we're saying on the record.
Hmm. And what was the idea for the video? How did that come about?
Well, we got together with Dave Taylor, mm-hmm. the director, and we were also talking about how started having a discussion about the stats on gun violence. And how shocking it is. And at one point, we started to list people, different people who are well-known people. And, you know, we decided to include Lee Harvey Oswald because he was also shot by Jack Ruby. We included Dimebag Darrell. Mm. You know, there is a shocking number of artists who have died because via gun violence.
Lee Harvey Oswald was not an artist.
No, but we listed Dimebag Darrell, and we listed other people like Lee Morgan, and people like that, John Lennon,
right?
Who also, you know, we listed people like Kurt Cobain, who died as a result of suicide. I don't know if we listed Terry Kath, but you know, there's a shocking amount of artists.
Wasn't Marvin Gaye killed by a gun too?
Yes, by his father.
By his father, yeah.
Marvin Gaye, right? That's the thing, right? Marvin Gaye.
And yeah, now that you guys are mentioning it, like, I've never realized how many there are.
Yeah.
Until you just said it. Yeah, it's crazy.
I was shocked at the stat. There was a song. Remember that band Consolidated? I don't know if you remember them back then.
Oh, sure.
So they had this song, Tool and Die, mm-hmm. about gun violence and how terrible it was in the 90s. And one of the things was an African-American male under the age of 35. That's the leading cause of violence. And I was like, oh, it's awful. And then the same stat is quoted in your video. And I was like, it hasn't changed. That shocked me to the core hearing that. Mm. And I was
the idea that all problems can be solved with a gun is crazy to me. That we've decided that in order to end an argument, to stop a conflict, to make things right, you have to have some sort of gun. And I don't mean like a revolver or a machine gun or anything, but just a show of force is the way that you stop these ideas, which is crazy.
Well, violence is an American way of life, though. I mean, stats, like, I'll tell you, like, ex-wives, girlfriends are right. under threat by their boyfriends and husbands. That happens a lot. And, suicide, you know, people take their own lives at a shocking rate, and we don't really even have all the numbers because, you know, the NRA's lobby that not to record all the stats, you know. So it's a very
they can't even treat it as a disease because they've lobbied against the CDC to make it impossible for them to do that. When anything else could be considered a disease, access to something that can be harmful can be considered a disease. Mm. Access, you know. And I have this argument constantly with my mother is like
you know, she loves to shoot. She's got a couple of handguns, and she is all for universal background checks. Pretty sure she's for liability insurance for ammunition. And she's that person. And I'm like, well, they're not enough of you.
Right.
They're not enough of you. And you're arguing, well, don't say I can't have it. I'm like, well, I'm so sorry, but I was raised by you that if I do this one more time, then all the toys go away.
Yeah. I bet you your mom's a pretty good shot, though.
She's pretty good.
I wanted to end things on maybe try to find a positive note.
Sure. your mom's a pretty good shot.
There it is. Boom. Thank you guys very much.
There you go. Annie Oakley over here.
No, I mean, did you guys have any, like, were there any moments in the studio, any songs that were really fun to work on, anything, like, that kind of sticks out to you as you
oh,
were,
yeah,
like...
Oh, yeah, man. Oh, yeah, yeah, well...
Because there's so much heavy content on it.
Oh, yeah. I definitely think Two Sides felt really special when we recorded it. I really like the way the song Always Wrong turned out. Yeah, I think the way that came about. The final version of Preaching Blues, I'm very happy that we chose that version of Preaching Blues.
Take 7 or...
Or 5.
Or 5.
I was, you know, I grew up a fan of your music, and, you know, many, many years later, I kind of got to, like, see it myself and get into this world. And, like, even in, like, I'm 36, and I think about all the things I would have maybe approached differently in my head. Not the actual physical things, because obviously you've been a great success. Right. But is there anything, like, if you could go back to, like, you know, the beginning and just talk to yourself and be like, yo, just do this way, like, do this way. Is there something paramount that you might tell yourself?
Pick, what's throw a highlight?
Throw a dart. Oh my God.
And this obviously goes for both of you.
What would I have done differently? You know, I honestly, the original breakup of the band, I would have had us take an actual hiatus, as opposed to the band breaking up. I probably would have said, listen, you know what? We should all do our solo records. We should all do other things for a while. That I would say.
Okay.
In all honesty, I would have said, you know what? I can't do this right now. We can't do this right now. Let's do some other things. At that time, it was a kind of very emotionally fraught time because I was also breaking up with my first wife, and so I was not available for this kind of sage wisdom at the time.
Right.
But that would have been the thing I would have suggested.
Okay. How about you, Corey?
It's... You know, I can't regret where I am right now.
Sure.
I'm very happy with where I am. I mean, I can mention a few instances where, you know, I should have turned left instead of right. But I'm pretty, you know, the happenstance of my life has been very, very fruitful. You know, the happenstance of meeting Vernon at that birthday party was very, very fruitful. The happenstance of me walking into Patricia Fields and finding that stupid ass wetsuit is, you know, very fortuitous for me. You know, knowing the people, meeting the people that I've met, and good, bad, or indifferent, it makes me who I am today. And I want to say there are a few things and there are a few people I shouldn't have met, but, you know, it's too bad.
Yeah,
you pulled off the wetsuit too. That campaign.
Yeah, you look fantastic. Yeah. Really,
you made it look cool. It's amazing.
Very few guys could have managed that.
Right on. Yeah.
All right.
Wow. Okay. Wow. I'm tired.
Yeah, that was an intense podcast. Great closing question by Benny once again. Yeah. Pulling it off. I wanted to. Thank Vernon Reed and Corey Glover for coming by. Also, thank their manager, Kevin Calabro, for setting it up. Their new album, Shade, is out now. You can get it. I know it's on sale at Best Buy. You can get it on iTunes. And yeah, if Living Color are playing in your town, definitely go see them. They still just kill it live.
They shred.
Exactly. So yeah, thanks to those guys. If you want to support our podcast, like we said up front, we're working on some new stuff for you. But in the meantime, you can always donate at venmo.com/offtrack. Brad's name will pop up. That means it's going to the right place. And if you leave us a funny comment, we will definitely see it. And we appreciate all your donations.
I'm going to throw some more props out there. Thank you, Aaron, Robert, Brandon, Ren, Shannon. Boy, Ed, of course. He's
Ed.
A regular.
Check out Ed's obscure band, Siobhan. Beach Slang.
Thank you, all of you people. These are great. You know, you're keeping our server costs going or whatever, but we're going to try and hit you guys back with some more incentives to keep doing that. And then also, if you don't have a Venmo account, I think you can still donate via PayPal.
Yeah.
On the website.
Yeah, if you go to goingofftrack.com. And yeah, and I'd like to thank everyone that sends me notes. I got a note today, someone saying, I know I'm a year and a half late, but I loved your Esty Haim episode.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I get these notes maybe like once a week from random people, and it's very nice that people like go out of their way to like find my email, sit down, write something. So I appreciate that.
Send the love.
Yes. All right. Well, yeah, hope you dug that episode. You can follow us online on Twitter at Going Off Track. You can give us a review on iTunes. You can do all that fun stuff. And yeah, we'll be back next Wednesday with another great episode. So see you then.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.